Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to another episode of the IC Interviews podcast. Today, we are honored to have the IC's most mysterious columnist, the enigmatic Bear Bull, with us on the show again. The Bear Bull column has been part of the IC pages for more than half a century, and prior to that, part of the Stock Exchange Gazette since the early 1950s. The current incarnation, Philip Ryland, is about to hand over the reins to a new steward after 25 years in the role. So we thought we'd get together today to talk about the past, present, and future of investing and markets. Philip Bear Bull, as I should call you, thank you for being here. Welcome to the show.
Dan, hi. Thanks for asking me.
So we're recording this in the final week of December. So really, it feels right to start with the near term, the year just gone and the year ahead. And the obvious question, given your moniker, are you bearish or bullish at the moment, be that through a global prism, the UK, or whatever you may prefer?
I suppose I'm moderately bearish. Well, okay, what do I think equities might be doing in the year just about to begin? If I can, I try to sort of sidestep forecasts, because forecasts are hostages to fortune, and often they're really just glorified guesswork. So if people ask me, what do I think about the future, I kind of say to them, well, what does the past tell us? The best guess of the future is often, what is a typical sort of year? A typical year for UK equities is, well, depending on your perspective, if you want to sort of take the average of the last 120 years or so, then typically I'd expect that UK equities are going to return about 5-6% this year. And on top of that, you've got a dividend yield of, let's say, 3.5% or thereabouts to come. Now, very conveniently, that would be sort of, you know, that's pretty much the average of the past 100 years or so, and that's not a bad return to be having. If we were talking in 12 months' time, as 24 is about to elapse into 25, and we were looking at an 8.5% return from UK equity, including dividends, and let's imagine that inflation stays, reasonably quiet. Again, we're guessing now a typical year for inflation might be sort of 3.5%. This coming year, it might be a bit more than that. But if we were talking in those terms, and therefore we were talking about a real return from UK equities of about 5% in 24, I'd be saying that's pretty damn good. I'd want to have that, because it would be rather more than we've got in the past few years. Now, whether we'll get it, I don't know. But my point is that would be fairly typical. So if it does happen, it would be nice, but it wouldn't be that unusual.
Let's turn to the backdrop, certainly for the UK, the economic backdrop, that is. In your column to be published at the end of December, so it will be available by the time this is broadcast, you talk about some of the issues facing the UK economy relating to things like productivity, etc. I mean, we're often told and reminded that the economy is not the stock market, and you know, the FTSE 100 is clearly very globally exposed. But can you say a little bit more about these issues and maybe the intimation in that column that the economy could have more bearings on UK returns in future if it hasn't been doing so already over the past 5-10 years or so?
In a way, it's not so much the economy which have the bigger bearing. Maybe it's the extent to which politics and matters relating to politics will affect the economy, which then affects the stock market, which affects stock market returns, and so on and so forth. First of all, one can throw in the caveat that, as you say, the economy is not the stock market, and that's certainly not the case in terms of a trading nation like the UK. I mean, what's the familiar figure we hear that is it about 40% of profits from FTSE 100 companies come from overseas? So, you know, if you're talking about a 40-60 ratio for FTSE 100 companies, then the UK economy is, it's important, but it's not fundamental. I think we all, you know, we're all getting used to the idea that the economic background for the UK is, for the UK, for the Western world in general, is not what it was. You know, we can simplify this and say that we're turning into an old society. We're turning into a society which is too fond of consuming and not fond enough of investing. We hear a lot about productivity or lack of productivity in the UK in particular, but also throughout the Western world. This is partly about not doing enough investing and doing too much consuming. The UK's productivity has been an issue for what? For a generation, for more than a generation now. The UK seemed to have got its act together in the 1990s, early 2000s, but then it's had a setback, as the rest of the world had a setback around about the time of the financial crisis in 2008-2009. What the UK didn't do was recover from that crisis in the way that other economies recovered. We still don't really know why that was the case, but we do know that the UK didn't recover well. The UK's productivity, therefore, has lagged behind the rest of the world, the rest of the developed world, quite substantially for the past 10 years or so, to the extent that, you know, we have an issue. We have an issue because we have a society that demands, that has a greater sense of entitlement than it's probably ever had. So its demands aren't diminishing, but the pressure on the government, the pressure on the economy, the pressure to produce is constant and growing, but the wealth isn't responding.
So when we relate this to the market and the UK market in particular, I suppose there are two things here. One, that's going to have a negative impact, of course, you know, at some level, on certainly on UK companies, whether listed or otherwise. Equally, though, when you look at UK share valuations, as of course we all do, and you look at things like, you know, the gap between US and UK share valuations, which, as you wrote about recently, is pretty wide, clearly given the success the US has continued to have at a market level. Is there a case for, to flip it on its head almost, is there a case for mean reversion here? I know that's a force with which you are, you know, you credit a decent amount in investing. And, you know, sometimes these things can't persist in perpetuity. So is there a contrarian case for the UK simply in relation to valuations currently, despite all you've just said?
Yeah, I think the most certainly is that the trouble is one doesn't know when it's going to happen. I mean, you can simplify. I think you can simplify and say that there are two sorts of investors. There are momentum investors and there are mean reversion investors. It's probably smarter to be a momentum investor because momentum always tends to be with us. Often we're not quite sure what the momentum is, but it's always there. Mean reversion sort of creeps up on us rather more unawares. Things flip. We don't quite know when they've flipped or why they've flipped, but we see it with hindsight that they've flipped. The new momentum, the change momentum takes us back to whatever the mean was. If the UK economy has been performing badly relative to other economies, if its stock market has been performing badly relative to other stock markets, then yes, at some stage you should expect that momentum will change, it will flip. And there'll be a new momentum, there will be, therefore, and mean reversion will cause that. So you can imagine it happening. I can certainly imagine it happening. I just don't know really when it's going to happen and what will cause it to happen. I mean, I look at this often in relation to the performance of the Bearable Income Fund. And I say to myself, well, you know, that used to perform very well. Now it's performing really rather poorly. I'm not doing anything very different. I think I'm much the same investor that I was in the good times as I am in the bad times. But, you know, now the results are bad. And one isn't quite sure why. And one thinks, well, things are not exactly wonderful, but they're not that bad. You know, what's going to happen to change it? And I wouldn't pretend to know what would happen to change it. But I would suggest that at some stage there will be a mean reversion, there will be a flip in the momentum, and stuff like value will come back into fashion. But as I say, quite when that might be, you know, your guess is as good as mine.
Yes, those catalysts are always what we're looking for, aren't we? Let's talk about the income fund then, the Bearable Income Fund, as you mentioned it. It is 25 years old this year. As you say, there hasn't been much you're doing differently now than you were a few years ago. But when you look back over, first of all, the whole period of running it, you know, what have you learned from running an income portfolio over that time? Are there lessons you can take also from the past couple of years, even if it's to an extent, you know, luck, circumstance, the fate of the market that has been changing things in the short term?
I suppose you could divide those 22, 25 years into two periods. Broadly speaking, there was the period up to sort of 2015, 2016, when it did very well. And then there's the period since then when it's done really pretty badly. A coincidence that that change in fortune also coincided with the change in fortunes of, it coincided with Brexit, of course, which is a big factor in all this. Brexit also coincided with the change in fortune in the returns from UK stock market. And in particular, value became far less fashionable than it was. Value fell out of fashion, and growth, to the extent that the UK market can offer growth, which is limited, became more fashionable. I mean, by and large, what I've always tried to do is buy good companies at decent prices. The caveat there, I suppose, would be that if one is running an income fund, then the choice of good companies tends to be more limited, because by definition, companies which offer comparably high dividend yields tend not to be the best growth companies. You know, if they were the best growth companies, then almost by definition, they wouldn't be offering a big fat yield on their dividend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so therein lies one particular problem of running income funds. There are probably two sorts of income funds, aren't there? There's an income fund in the making, and there's an income fund which is actually an income fund which is churning out regular chunks of income. The way you build up an income fund so that it can produce income in the future isn't the way you would run an income fund when it becomes just that, a fund which is there to produce a regular income for its beneficiaries. The Bearville Income Fund was a bit odd in the sense that it always said it will distribute all the dividends that it can generate. It will always aim to generate, it was a yield of about 1.2, 1.3 times the all shares average. That was its target, that was its target yield, and it would distribute all the income that it generated. That caused an artificial constraint, because in the real world, if one is building an income fund, one would be redistributing that income. The Bearville Fund never set out to do that, in a sense, wasn't able to do that. So it had the aim of distributing all the income whilst simultaneously and to grow the real value of its capital. And it has done that. And it did that marvelously well, if you like, for the first 15 years or so. And it's done that badly in the last 7 years or so. It's done that badly in the sense that it's still been able to churn out regular growing dividends, with the exception of the year 2020, which, you know, was very exceptional. But the real value of its capital has fallen in the past 7 years. That still means that over the whole of the 25 years of the fund, the real value of its capital has exceeded inflation by a wide margin, and it's beaten the all-share index by a wide margin. So that's all jolly good. But as we keep saying, that long-term success from the particular success of the first half of its existence.
One thing you've been looking at this year with the portfolio is some overseas shares, considering how to add those if there are certain companies that could be added to the portfolio on an income basis. What kind of success or otherwise have you had in that search? What kind of companies have you found? Are they distinct from UK shares in any particular way, or just different / better versions in some cases? How have you found that experience?
It's probably too early to judge. Hindsight would tell us that this is something which I should have done before I did it. Hindsight tells us that it's something I should have done some years ago. One of the problems, I suppose, with running an income fund is that one will tend to be particularly UK orientated.
Mm.
And yield tend to be. In doing this, in starting down that road, I was keenly aware that my timing may not be great because of the mean reversion point we were making just a couple of minutes ago. That I'm diversifying away from the UK just at the point when the UK might be at its nadir, at the bottom of its cycle. So to the extent that I was diversifying away, then I'm also saying to myself, well, okay, actually, at any given point, I might have to switch back to the UK. If it becomes clear that the UK suddenly has momentum, then it would be foolish for me to take money from the UK and put it into the United States or elsewhere. I'm investing in the US basically because in practical terms, that's where it's easiest for UK investors to go. They fill out the little magical W8 BEN form, and that means that they will receive their dividends via their stockbroker. They will receive their dividends from US companies via their stockbrokers with no problems. Giving dividends from European companies is much more problematic, so problematic that by and large, I think it's not worth the effort. You know, there might be one or two exceptions to that. Nestle would probably be an exception to that. But by and large, if you're going to invest for income overseas, then forget about all markets except the United States. And in a way, that's fine because, you know, the United States is such a big market. It gives you lots of opportunities anyway. And despite the fact that the yield on the US market, I'm guessing now, is probably about, 2.2%, something like that, compared with the average yield on the UK on UK shares of more like 3.5%. Despite that, there are, you know, plenty of good quality dividend companies on offer in the US market.
When we look at company valuation, Charlie Munger, who obviously sadly passed away this year, one comment he made that stands out perhaps in the current moment is, you know, it's better to buy great companies at a fair valuation rather than vice versa, essentially. Do you agree with that principle? Do you think that's a sensible case? Of course, there are always two sides to two such cases, but how do you consider that dictum, as it were, in the current market environment?
I think it probably works in any market environment. If you were trying to simplify what I try to do, then that's a good way of expressing it.
Mm.
I suppose, broadly speaking, you could say that you buy two sorts of companies, don't you? I mean, it's the two sides of the value investment story. There's Buffett Mark I, who bought cigar box companies, where you buy a poor company for a great price, I'm caricaturing now, obviously. You've got a choice. You buy a poor company at a great price, or you buy a great company at a fair price. Mark I Buffett did the earlier exercise. He bought companies where the share price was below their net asset value, often well below the net asset value, and waited for that discount to unwind, however it unwound. Or you buy companies probably for much more than their net asset value, but that doesn't really matter because the companies are going to grow, and then in the long run you'll be much better off than that. It's not just Munger who sort of lighted on that truth. I think several growth investors also sort of pointed in that direction. Munger, I suppose, had the most influence on Buffett because he was closest to Buffett.
Sure. We'll come back to investment philosophy in a moment, but I wanted to talk about portfolio construction a little more first. Another thing we on the IC and you in particular have written about a few points this year is bonds, gilts, of course, in the UK context. Now, the yields there are clearly much higher than they have been for a long time, making them look relatively attractive for the first time in quite a while. How do you see those attractions relative to UK equities at the moment in a generic portfolio, if you can generalize in such ways, but also, you know, just comparing like for like almost?
Any portfolio has to be diversified. Or at least I think it does. And there are only so many things with which one can diversify. In practical terms, there are only so many things with which one can diversify a portfolio. I guess they come down to four sorts of assets, don't they? They come down to equities, they come down to bonds, they come down to commodities, and I suppose maybe also they come down to real estate, to property, although in practical terms, property is often just a subset of equities. Let's keep it simple. Those three asset classes, commodities, bonds, and equities, they don't all move in the same direction. So therefore, and in particular, bonds and equities will tend not to move in the same direction. I mean, they do quite a lot of the time, but they don't at other times because bonds are so sensitive. So therefore, any sensible portfolio should have a mix of those three, because that's where you get diversification from. That's where you will tend to take out the volatility from returns without affecting the average of investment returns too much. So there's that general point to be made about bonds. There's a more specific point: do they offer value at the moment? because of the yields they offer. I'm not sure. Yes and no is the slightly unhelpful answer. I mean, I was struck, for example, a couple of months ago or so, I've written about this a couple of times, I was struck by the comparatively sat yields being offered by index linked bond. And I thought that money for nothing situation, that you had the situation where, go back a couple of years ago, and the redemption yields on index linked bonds were almost universally negative. And it was ridiculous. It was, you know, you looked at these figures, I mean, quite literally, redemption yields on medium dated index linked stocks were negatives. And you thought, well, it's funny how one sort of accepts ridiculous things at the time without questioning them often enough. But, you know, it was ridiculous. And you sort of shrugged your shoulders and said, well, that's the way interests are on rates. You know, that's the way interest rates are nowadays. They're just, everything is ridiculous about them. But sooner or later, these ridiculous things unwind. So negative yields on index-linked bonds in a period of time last year, last year and the year before, they changed from being negative to being positive. And suddenly, you know, just a few months ago, you were in a situation where for a 12 or 15-year-old index-linked bond, you were being offered a 1.2 or 1.3% real return. And then when you started saying to yourself, well, okay, yeah, that 1.2, that 1.3% real return, actually, that's a real return against the retail price index of inflation. And we all know the retail price index of inflation runs, because of the way it's constructed, that runs ahead of the consumer price level of inflation, the government's favorite measure, in the long run, by about a percentage point. And I think I worked it out the other day. In fact, it's in Burble, I think, sometime last week or soon. It's a 0.9 percentage point difference. So you were talking just a couple of months ago, you were talking about real returns from index-linked gilt of about something over 2%, you know, sort of 2.1, 2.2%. Now, you know, that's risk-free. That's as risk-free as it gets. What's not to like about that? I mean, that was a wonderful opportunity. And interestingly, I wouldn't say that gap has been completely closed, but a 1.2% real yield has now been shaved down to, I don't know, it's about sort of 0.8, maybe 0.9%. So that's still not bad, because, you know, don't forget, you're getting a guaranteed rate. That's returns in excess of retail price index. So in nominal terms, it's not at all bad, and you're taking zero risk for that. If you've got depending on your investment horizon, because you need basically matching the gilt stock with whatever investment horizon you have. But if you've got a, you know, if you've got a 10, 12 year investment horizon, which is perfectly normal for people who are saving for the long term, then why would you not take that up? Why would you not put some of your portfolio into that? I mean, it would be ridiculous not to.
As a general, you know, putting aside the individual opportunities, from what you said at the top there, suggest to me you do still see bonds as, you know, a valuable diversifier in portfolios, because there's been, of course, a lot of talk about how a, you know, quote unquote 60-40 portfolio can function, you know, whether it can still function in the modern age, even in an environment now where, you know, yields are much higher and there's much more scope for bonds to have something to give, as it were. So do you think that is still the bond equity portfolio is still something that's going to hold up as a basic diversification principle in the years ahead?
I don't see why not. I mean, it has done in the past. It is true that certainly from a UK perspective, it's certainly true that the short-term effect of what, you know, is kind of, we're talking about the, as it were, we're talking about the Truss effect here, the effect of Liz Truss's short-term premiership and the infamous budget that was cooked up. You know, round about that time, the effect of that premiership did truly amazing things to gilt prices, and suddenly, from being low risk assets for a while, they became hyper risk assets. I mean, the figures, you could kind of hardly believe the rate at which index linked stock, in particular, was falling. And so you had this weird situation where index-linked stocks, which had been, as they should be, they had been characteristically low-risk investments for the previous 20 years or so, which is what you'd expect. Suddenly they became almost as risky as, let's say, commodities or oil. It was really quite bizarre. And I think that kind of threw a lot of people. And maybe we're getting back to normality now. I think we're getting back to normality, but I suppose one can't be sure of that. So for a while, it wasn't quite clear what bonds were supposed to do. There's really no getting away from the fact that bonds will respond to rising interest rates in a predictable way, or they will respond to changes in interest rate in a predictable way. Interest rates rise, their prices will fall. Interest rates fall, their prices will rise. That's what will happen. Equities will respond in a slightly different way to the way that bonds will respond when inflation is rising or falling, or growth is rising or falling. Sometimes equities will respond in the same way as bonds, but not always, because it's sometimes rather than always. That's when the diversification benefits of having some bonds in a portfolio will become clear. So if you're sad enough like me that from time to time you put the monthly data on a spreadsheet and you look at the correlation in price movements between equities and bonds over a long period of time, then there's no doubt that they provide diversification benefits. The correlation coefficient is probably just about positive. In other words, in the long run, bonds and equities just about move in the same direction. But on the other hand, you really won't get better diversification benefits than if you use bonds. You know, all equities, whether you like it or not, all equity returns will be positively correlated. Idea of having a portfolio of equities which will be well diversified for risk it won't happen. I'm sorry, it doesn't happen. So if you want diversification, you need bonds. You also, just by the by, you also need commodities. You need gold in particular. You probably also need oil. I think I'm right in saying that gold will have a negative correlation. So you need those things, but you certainly also need bonds.
Mm. We're running short of time, unfortunately, but I do want to talk about, as I said earlier, the sort of investment philosophy that you may have, if we can use such grandiose terms. And maybe a good way to talk about that is in your last column of the year, where you talk about the kind of investor that the reader may want to be. Can you say a little about the thinking behind that and what ideas you're exploring there, I think, in relation to the efficient markets hypothesis?
Investors, by definition, are savers. So generically, we're talking about this category of people who are called savers, people who have surpluses. If you have a surplus, then by definition, you have to save it. The question is, what do you do with it? What do you do with those savings? So if we have, if we have a spectrum of savers, on the one end of the spectrum, you'll have those who are as risk averse as possible to be. You've got those who want to take almost no risk at all. That's at one end of the spectrum. So they're going to be people who put their money into savings accounts and not a lot else. And then as you travel along this spectrum from the most risk averse to the most risk embracing, then you get people who want to put their money into stuff like equities, people who are probably saving, they will be saving for the longer term, as they should be if they're putting their money into equities. And then, you get a spectrum within equities themselves. And that runs from, it should run from income stock, although arguably it hasn't been doing that lately. It should run from income stocks to conventional growth stock, to those, to derivatives and so on and so forth. So you've got, you have this spectrum of risk, and investors need to decide where they want to put themselves on this spectrum. And importantly, with respect to the efficient market hypothesis, they need to ask themselves whether it's really worthwhile putting themselves on the far end of the risk spectrum in the hope of getting excess rewards, but certainly not with any clear certainty of getting those excess rewards.
And there was a quote you mentioned when we were speaking off air before recording that I thought was quite pertinent too, talking when we consider, because effectively what we're talking about here in some ways is, whether you're going to be a passive investor or an active investor. And can you say a little bit more about that and about know, this ability to maybe be both.
It was the notion about holding two contradictory views in your mind simultaneously, wasn't it? About that being the definition of genius. So on the one hand, the efficient market hypothesis is terribly powerful. I mean, in simple terms, it tells us that it's impossible to beat the market on a systematic basis without putting in something extra. We all know that prices are inefficient. We all know that markets are inefficient to the extent that prices are always changing. And because prices are always changing and because they're volatile, then people sort of say, yes, that's a clear indication that the market is not efficient. It's inefficient. But it's not really like that. The market is efficient because at any given point, it's very difficult to say with confidence that a price is wrong and that therefore it will be corrected in the future. We see, you know, we may see stock prices falling very rapidly. In a period of panic, we'll see them falling rapidly. And so thoughts may turn to inefficient pricing. But it's very difficult systematically when you're in that sort of situation to say that, yes, a price is wrong. And because you can't say a price is always wrong, then therefore you can't say with confidence that that the market is inefficient. Then you have to conclude that the market, it's not actually efficient, but it tends to efficiency. And because it tends to efficiency, it's very difficult to beat a market which tends towards efficiency. It tends towards efficiency because, you know, there are a lot of people putting a lot of input into those prices. And some of the people are very smart and they're very well connected and they're very, you know, they're clued up and so on and so forth. The sum of investors is what powers markets. So if you're going to be an active investor, you have to sort of ask yourself, well, okay, what do I bring that's special, which means that I can beat that market? The price of the market is its average level. I mean, you know, they don't call the Dow Jones average the average for nothing. It's because it's the average price that is made by you and I and millions of other investors who, you know, who buy and sell these things. So you're competing against a lot of people when you're an active investor. And it does kind of help to stand back from that and say to yourself, well, okay, well, if I'm competing against all these people, why am I so smart that I think I can beat? I don't know. I mean, personally speaking, when I ask that question, I find it very difficult to answer and say, well, yeah, I am smart enough to beat them. I mean, I might try to do it, but that's partly another matter. Whether I really expect to succeed in doing it is very debatable because, you know, why should I be? Why should I be smarter than all these other people who make up the market? So you have this kind of contradictory thought. Okay, you're trying to be an active investor, partly because it's hugely, you know, it's hugely interesting being an active investor. It requires a lot of time. It requires a lot of thought, and that's interesting in itself.
Well, that feels like a good place to end. Thank you very much for sharing your time with us. And I'm sure all listeners and readers of the IC will join me in saying thank you as well for your contributions to the publication over the years. They've been greatly appreciated.
Thanks, Dan. Thank you.
That brings us to the end of this IC Interviews podcast, but we'll be back next time with another chat. So do join us then. Thank you and goodbye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.